Rachel. Thank you. Thank you. It is an honor to be here with all of you. Thank you so much for turning out. You know, I would like to get quickly to your questions, so I'll try to keep my stump pretty short. But I was speaking at a factory in my district back in Massachusetts not too long ago. And it turned out to be a factory that made some of the advanced optics that we used in the Marine Corps. I was so proud that they were made at home in Massachusetts. So I spoke to all the workers on the factory floor. And I said, thank you for being a part of our national defense. Thank you for being a great example of advanced manufacturing right here in Massachusetts. And then I opened it to questions, and there was silence. No one had a question. And I said, look, I'm a politician. I can take tough questions. Don't be shy. Ask anything you'd like. But there was still silence. And then finally, a woman in the back raised her hand, and she said, who are you? And so it was a lesson that before you take questions, take a little bit of time to introduce yourself. So I will take just a few minutes to say who I am, what I value, and why I'm running for president. I'm Seth Moulton. I served 4 tours in Iraq, leading Marines in the infantry on the ground. And oh, thank you very much, sir. And over the course of leading the Marines in over 4 tours, the Marines I led asked a lot of questions. Big questions like, what kind of rocket do we use here, sir? And small questions like, how to send a postcard to their parents. But the single question I got most, or at least the one that was the hardest, was this. It was, sir, why the hell are we risking our lives for this? Now, the Marines who asked that were of many ranks and backgrounds from all over the country with different political persuasions, different religious beliefs, but they were all right to ask that question because I was asking it myself. And fundamentally, we were in a war that shouldn't have happened, started by leaders who didn't live up to our values. And I share that little story today because I think a lot of people in America are asking a similar question right now. What does it mean to fight for a country that doesn't live up to our values? What does it mean when we have leaders who we fundamentally can't trust? That's what's at stake in this election, our values, our country. And so I'd like to take a few minutes to just talk a little bit about why we fight. Because the answer I gave to those Marines back then is the same answer today. We fight to uphold the values that our leaders are failing to uphold themselves. So why do we fight? We fight in 2020 for basic human rights. Not the right to carry an AR-15 wherever you want, no matter who you are, but the right to be able to send your kids to school and know that they're not going to get shot before they come home. We fight for basic human rights, like knowing that you can live in this country as a person of color and not be persecuted by a white nationalist administration. We fight the right for healthcare so that everybody in America can afford healthcare without having to start a GoFundMe on the internet or search the web for life-saving medications every time you get sick. And we fight for every woman's right to choose. So that the right to choose is a decision that a woman makes with her doctor on her terms. We fight in 2020 for justice, because justice is not being served when a man sells $20 of weed in Louisiana and gets thrown in prison for life. We deserve a criminal justice system where there aren't different rules that put black people in prison for things that white people do every single day. And we fight in 2020 for justice because justice means justice starts at the top. And that means that impeachment proceedings against Donald Trump should begin tomorrow. Because in America, nobody, no matter rank, privilege, title, color of their skin, or office that they hold, puts them above the law. We fight in 2020 for opportunity. Now, let me just ask you a quick question. How many of you paid more than a dollar in taxes last year? A few people? Okay, so all of you, actually, forget that. Just you, sir. You, on your own, paid more in taxes than Amazon and Netflix and Delta Airlines combined. Now, I don't have any problem with those companies per se, but that system just isn't fair. That doesn't make sense. We need a tax system that truly makes opportunity for all, that rewards people who work for a living, not just for people who figure out how to evade paying taxes. That's true opportunity in America. And we fight in 2020 for democracy, because in a democracy, every single vote should count. And that's just simply not the case when we have gerrymandering, the filibuster, and the Electoral College. So we've got to bring democracy back to America. And there's one thing more. We fight in 2020 for patriotism, to reclaim patriotism from the right-wing conservative politicians who claim to own it. Because I know patriotism, and you know patriotism. I saw it in the Marines I served with every single day in Iraq. I see it in the kids who are walking out of school to stop gun violence. I see it in the teachers who are striking for fair pay. I see it in the women who are standing up for basic rights. Because that's real patriotism. Patriotism isn't just hugging the flag like Donald Trump likes to do. Patriotism is standing up every single day and fighting for the values that our flag represents. So that's what's at stake in 2020. That's what's at stake in this election, our country, our values. And we can win if we come together. Because the other thing I said to the Marines who asked that tough question in Iraq, why the hell are we here, sir? The thing I said to them is, we're here so that nobody has to go in our place. Because it's when our values are under attack that we need to step up and fight for them. It's when our country lets us down that we need to step up and serve. To win this election, it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be as easy to beat Donald Trump as some Democrats like to think. To do so, we need to bring together a remarkably diverse coalition, a coalition that includes everybody in the Democratic Party. And we got to get everybody to turn out. We can't leave anybody out. But also includes independent voters. Some Obama, Trump voters, I'm sure there are some of you here today, and even some disaffected Republicans. I know I can build a coalition like that because I've done so before in some of the most difficult circumstances on earth. That was my job in Iraq, and I've seen other Americans do it too. I know what it takes. It also is time for a new generation of leadership in America. I think it's time for the generation that fought in Iraq to step in for the generation that sent us there. I think it's time for the generation that's going to have to live with the effects of climate change to step in for the generation that got us here. That's what's at stake in this election, and that's what we can do if we come together, not only to win in 2020, but to get all this good work done in 2021. And then we can truly live, we can truly leave a better country for our children, for children like my 10-month-old daughter, Emmy, so that she grows up in an America that is stronger and more united than it has ever been before. Thank you very much, Iowa. I've got a few minutes left, so I would love to take a few questions from the crowd. Yes, sir, in the sunglasses.
Hi, thank you for running for president, sir. I know Iowa has experienced unseasonably warm weather, but that impacted agriculture in this country, not in the state. So I would say, what's your agenda on climate change so we can mitigate the impact of agriculture that is our...
So the question is, what is my agenda on climate change? So first of all, America's got to get back to being a leader on climate change. A lot of the candidates have said we need to get back into the Paris Accord, but I'm asking a fundamental question. Why is it even the Paris Accord to begin with? Why isn't it the Washington Accord or the Des Moines Accord? We should be setting the climate change agenda for the world. And we shouldn't be buying technology from China. If we want to put together solar farms, we should have the best and latest technology coming from the United States of America. It's a false dichotomy that we need to put a big tax on American consumers in order to deal with climate change. We can grow the green economy while dealing with climate change and setting the pace for the rest of the world. We need to make sure that every developed country in the world follows our agenda for how to make carbon-free energy. And that includes investing in things like fusion power, because that is the future of energy in the developed world. It also includes acknowledging the fact that there's a lot of carbon coming from the developing world. But that's another challenge that America can meet by producing technology for distributed power that we can sell across the globe. And third, we need to invest in decarbonization because there's too much carbon up there right now, and we need to pull it out of the atmosphere. I have the most ambitious national service plan of any presidential candidate, actually of anyone since the 1930s in the Civilian Conservation Corps. And a centerpiece of that program is called a Federal Green Corps that will put young Americans to work serving their country, making us more climate resilient. That's how we not only tackle climate change today, but prepare our young people to succeed in the green economy tomorrow. Thank you. Yes, ma'am. Front row.
I want to know what your plan is to tackle the debt so that your daughter and my grandchildren aren't saddled with it and that our budget doesn't continue to pay interest that could be used for other programs.
Ma'am, you asked a question that not enough people are asking in this race, which is, what is your plan to tackle the debt? Because we now have the biggest deficit in American history, thanks to Donald Trump and the Republicans in Congress and their tax cut. And people like me, running for president, we ought to have a plan to address it. So here's what I would do. I have the most ambitious revenue program, I think, of any candidate in this race. But it just comes down to making the tax system fair and making people who owe taxes actually pay it. I think the capital gains rate, the rate that you pay if you are investing for a living, should be the same as the ordinary income rate if you're working for a living. That's a centerpiece. Second, we just need to make sure that all the people who owe taxes are actually paying them. That alone would raise $500 billion a year. Think about that, $500 billion, $500 trillion a year just to make sure people are actually paying their taxes. And the corporate tax rate, which was lowered to 21, should go back up to 25. Not as high as it was, because we do need to remain competitive with the rest of the world, but back up to 25. And that's a tax plan that says to every American, you're not evil if you're rich. We should aspire to be successful. We're not pitting rich people against poor people, but we are making sure that everybody pays their fair share. And that tax plan that I just outlined will raise more revenue than Elizabeth Warren's. So it's an ambitious plan, but it's based in the idea that every American deserves a chance to succeed. That's what I call it, a chance to succeed. Because no matter who you are, where you come from, what your background is, what kind of education you got, who your parents were, everybody in America deserves a chance to succeed. That's what a country of equal opportunity is all about. We're not a country of equal results. Some people seem to think that. That's socialism, all right? We are a capitalist country of equal opportunity where everybody should have a chance to succeed, and that's what my plan would do. Thank you very much for that question. Okay. Yes, sir.
I think it's clear that you're not a big fan of Nancy Pelosi. Is it hard to run for president when you're not in bed with the Speaker of the House?
Is it hard to run for president when I'm not in bed with the Democratic establishment? You know, it's funny. Everywhere I've gone across this country, as someone who's been willing to call for new leadership, who doesn't just talk about it, but actually fights for it every single day. From the first time when I ran for Congress and took on an 18-year incumbent in my own party, everywhere I go, people don't say, or at least I have yet to hear anyone say, Seth, you know, I wish you'd just be a little bit more Washington establishment. I wish you'd do what all those people, those leaders in your party in Washington tell you to do. No. Americans want people who are willing to stand up to the Washington establishment. And in that very first race, when I took on an 18-year incumbent, I was told by the Massachusetts Democratic establishment, Seth, not only are you going to lose this race, but you'll never be involved in politics again. And think about that. What they were saying to this young combat veteran just a few years after I'd gotten out of the war was, do not participate in the democracy you risk your life to defend. And that is wrong. And you know it's wrong. And the voters in Massachusetts knew that it was wrong. Now, the thing the establishment was right about is it was a tough race. And I was an underdog in that race, just like I'm an underdog in this one. We did our first poll after 7 months, and I was only 53 points down. If you don't know much about politics, that's not good. I'd already been running for twice as long as I've been running for president. But the message I was hearing on the ground was different. People wanted a new voice. They wanted a new generation of leadership. And I came back and ended up winning that race by 11. So what I'm hearing from Americans is that they want people who are willing to stand up to the Washington establishment and not just talk about a new generation of leadership in our country, but actually fight to bring it. Thank you. Do we have time for more? All right. Our timekeeper here. All right. Yes, sir. The blue shirt. Good to see you.
What are your plans to make childcare more accessible and affordable for low-income families?
What are my plans to make childcare more accessible and affordable for low-income families? I mean, this is something that hits home to me. You know, as I'm planning out my next few days, I'm single parenting on Monday, coming down from New Hampshire because my wife has to go to work. She has to go to New York for business. And so it's going to be me and Emmy on our own. And we're adjusting our schedule for that. And it's given me so much more respect for people who single parent all day long. Frankly, like my wife is doing today. Because it's really hard. And we need to make childcare more accessible for everybody in America. First of all, I've voted in Congress many times for the Family Leave Act, for making sure, I've been on the record co-sponsoring the bills, saying that we need to get risk the rest of the world here and allow family and medical leave for everybody in America. That should be a standard. I also have an innovative plan to work with public libraries to provide childcare. A lot of people aren't using public libraries as much as they used to. We can put those spaces to work providing childcare for kids. And that's something that can extend to every community in this country. Use existing resources so it's not too expensive, but give parents the opportunity to work for a living while also raising a child. That's an opportunity that Liz and I are fortunate to have with Emmy. But I've seen over the last 10 months how hard it can be. And we have a lot of work to do to make it easier for everybody. Thank you. Yes, ma'am. So the question is, how do we get healthcare for everybody? So this is a good question. There's a lot of debate about this in this race. Some people are pushing Medicare for all, forcing everybody onto a government plan. Other people are saying that we should have a public option. I'm actually the only candidate in this race who gets single-payer healthcare. So it gives me a unique perspective on this question because I made a commitment to continue going to the VA for my healthcare, even as a member of Congress. I said, if my fellow veterans are going there, and the system is broken, then I'm gonna be there myself as a lawmaker seeing it firsthand. And I'll tell you, I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly of single-payer healthcare. There are some things that are good, like the VA actually negotiates prescription drug prices, which Medicare does not. So we get lower prescription prices at the VA than people do on Medicare. That's a good thing. But the first time I got surgery at the VA, well, to make a long story short, they literally sent me home with the wrong medications. And it was, well, what I thought at the time was a pretty serious abdominal surgery. It was quite painful. Of course, then my wife got a C-section when Emmy was born, and I was like, okay, that wasn't such a bad surgery. But it hurt a lot at the time. And I was lucky that the medication they sent me home with by mistake was just they sent me home with Advil when I was supposed to have a strong painkiller. Imagine if they'd sent me home with a stronger or more addictive medicine than I was supposed to get. We've heard the stories of veterans literally committing suicide in VA waiting rooms because they can't get the mental health care that they need. And I've talked a lot about mental health care in this campaign. But because of that experience, I believe that competition in the system would help. So I'm with President Obama that we should have a public option, better and more modern than Medicare, because that plan was designed in 1963, that competes with private healthcare plans. And if you have a great healthcare plan that you've fought for in your union or that you have through your employer and you want to keep it, that's fine. Just know that there's going to be some competition from a public option out there that's going to put downward pressure on prices, that's going to put downward pressure on prescription drugs, and is going to actually improve outcome for everybody. Look, if I came up here and said, you know what, that United States Postal Service, That's the only option that you all should have. We should put FedEx and UPS out of business. I don't think people would think that that would improve service in the country for delivering packages. And if you have choices for delivering your packages, you should have choices for delivering your healthcare. So that's all the time that I have. It's an honor to be here. Thank you so much for listening to me. Go vote for me. Put a corn kernel in the jar and vote for me. And I look forward to seeing you out there again, Iowa. Thank you very much.